Our next portion is going to be served to us by Brother Allen. Brother Allen would like to ask us all a question. What are you doing, Brother Allen? Dear friends, it's good to be with you. I want to bring you the love of your brethren in Piqua. Also, in talking with the brethren in Colorado, they asked their love be conveyed to the convention, particularly Brother Jim and Sister Debbie Moss. We're glad to convey that to you. Brother Brent, more or less, asked us a question, somewhat a rhetorical question this morning. I'll rephrase it for him, if I might. If you were to ask yourself, who was the most remarkable character of the New Testament, I'm sure that each of us might have a different choice, or we might make a different list of choices. But certainly, on many lists, at the top, at the head of that list, would be the Apostle Paul. For this hour, we would like to consider not a New Testament character, not one who was a follower of Christ, but an Old Testament character. If I were to ask you to make a list of candidates for the title Mighty Men of God, who would be on your list? I'm sure that each one of us would have a different list there also, and the ranking that we would give would likewise vary. These mighty men of God, some of them are brought to our attention in the 11th chapter of Hebrews. And there are many good candidates for that distinction. Moses, the miracles that were wrought by his hand, the plagues upon Egypt, the passing over of the firstborn, the parting of the Red Sea, all of these were remarkable miracles. Remarkable events demonstrating that he indeed was a mighty man of God. Joshua, his successor, and the events that the Lord wrought by his hand are also remarkable. The crossing of Jordan at flood stage, the subsequent defeat of the city of Jericho, we're all familiar with these events. And then, of course, there is the prophet Daniel. His dreams, the interpretation of those dreams, his deliverance from the mouth of the lions, all of these appeal to us as indications that these were mighty men of God. But I have to admit that I do have a name at the top of my list, and I'm somewhat prejudiced in who I have selected as my favorite for this distinction. Mighty man of God. For there is only one prophet that carries, even with his very name, this significance. And perhaps you've already guessed who that is. Elijah the Tishbite. For his name, Elijah, literally in the Hebrew, means mighty man of God. Elijah is not only important to us because of the Reformation work that he did amongst the children of Israel, not only because of the mighty miracles that he worked, but also, and more importantly, because he is a picture of the church in the flesh. And as such, it is important for us, the church in the flesh, to consider his life and its significance to each of us. Perhaps you have already guessed also the meaning for the title of this consideration. What are you doing? Do you remember who it was that asked that question and the circumstances that surrounded it? It was the Lord speaking to Elijah. Jehovah asked him this question. What are you doing? We, representative of the Elijah class, we as members of the church in the flesh, then must consider. The Heavenly Father is also perhaps asking us this same question. What are you doing? Though it is obvious now as to where the subject matter comes from, what may not be so obvious is its antitypical significance and its application to us at the end of the age. We would like to start by tracing the early history of Elijah's career that led up to this question. This is brought to our attention in chapter 17 through 19 of 1 Kings. And we would direct your attention there. Elijah had already been a prophet of God for some time. We are not told how long. Elijah literally burst upon the scene in this 17th chapter. It is the first reference that I'm aware of concerning his ministry. The antitypical significance, of course, refers to the church in the flesh, and the events that Elijah portrays are events chronologically that occur sometime after the church's career in the flesh had already begun. The time period is given to us in a veiled reference in the first verse. And Elijah the Tishbite, who was of the inhabitants of Gilead, said unto Ahab, As the Lord God of Israel liveth, before whom I stand, there shall not be dew nor rain these years, but according to my word. This reference to these years is explained for us in other places in the New Testament. In James chapter 5, 17, we find out that it is 3.5 years, the specific period, 1,260 days. And this 1,260-day period is spoken of in the 12th chapter of Revelation and also in the 12th chapter of Daniel. And thus we have very clearly marked out for us what segment of time is being spoken of here in the church's career, the 1,260 prophetic years, beginning in 539 A.D. and ending in 1799. Now, it was during this period, the period during which this picture applies, that we are told that Elijah went into the wilderness and he drank of the brook Cherith, and he was fed, according to the word of the Lord, or by the Lord's arrangement, by ravens, who fed him continually, day by day. And of course, we understand the significance here being that the raven, as an unclean bird, it would show very clearly that Elijah, the church, was fed during this time period by the only source of truth that was available, from the Catholic Church, the papacy. But we are also told that subsequently the brook Cherith dried up. Elijah's source of sustenance thus was endangered, and so the Lord directed him to the next place, which was Zarephath. And there was a particular widow to whom he was to go. It was God's instruction that took him to Zarephath, and it is interesting to note the meaning of this word. You may have a reference to it in your margin, but if not, the Strong's reference indicates the word means refinement. And so what we would be looking for is something within the history of the church in those early years after 539 that would constitute a refining work. You may also recall that when he went to Zarephath, that there was a widow there who sustained him, and the means of sustenance was not anything new. It was something that was already in existence. It was the barrel of meal and the cruse of oil that was continued. And we are told that It would waste not, neither would it fail, until the day that the Lord sent rain upon the earth. This sustenance was to last them throughout the entire period of the 1260 years. We believe that there is something that corresponds to this refining work within that period of time, a change that took place after 539 AD. And as we search church history, we believe that it very closely would corroborate or very closely correspond to the work of Waldo and of others that started in the year 1160. In the 15th verse, we are told that Elijah and the widow and her household did eat of this meal and the cruse of oil for many days. In the margin, the reference is to a full year, and we believe that this is the correct rendering. The many days, the full year, would therefore correspond to a period of 360 years, prophetically. If we take 360 years, starting in the year 1160, it brings us to a very significant date in church history, 1520, and the beginning of the Reformation. And we believe that this is the picture intended here by the Lord. It was during this one-year period that the widow's son died and was restored by Elijah. If we were to take roughly the midpoint between 1160 and 1520, it would take us to the middle of the 14th century. And as we look once again at history, we find that perhaps the next significant event in the church's career after 1160 and the work of Waldo and others was in 1371 and the ministry of Wycliffe. We're not going to spend a great deal of time going into the details here. We're simply trying to give an overview, and you can research some of these things in your own personal study. Now, it was at the end of this year that he spent with the widow, which would take us to 1520, that the 18th chapter begins. And it came to pass after many days that the word of the Lord came to Elijah in the third year, saying, "Go, show thyself unto Ahab, and I will send rain upon the earth." The reference here to the third year would mean the third year of the 3.5 years that Elijah mentioned at the beginning of the 17th chapter. This would corroborate our application of 1520 to the end of the year that he spent with the widow of Zarephath. For 1520 would be within that third year of the 3.5 years. We also believe that the showing of himself to Ahab would correspond to the beginning of the Reformation movement. For it was then the church essentially came out of hiding, if you will, and began to show herself more openly, and particularly in her opposition to papacy. A further corroboration of this picture then would be the subsequent contest with the priests of Baal. Their humiliation, Elijah's repairing of the altar of the Lord that had been broken down, their miraculous consumption of the sacrifice, and finally resulting in the slaying of the priests of Baal. We believe that the period that is covered here is the Reformation era that ended with 1789, the French Revolution corresponding to the slaying of the priests of Baal. And finally, after this, the rain returned. The end of the 3.5 years came, bringing us to 1799. And thus we have the background that leads us up more particularly to our study for this morning. Elijah, a marvelous miracle, a spectacular miracle was wrought by his hands in the defeat of the priests of Baal. 850 of the priests of Baal and the prophets of the grove against this one lone individual who was willing to stand up for the God of Israel. And when we consider the lesson of the previous hour and the Apostle Paul and some of the characteristics that he had, we cannot help but think that Elijah, as a picture of the church, also portrays some of these same characteristics. He was willing, against these tremendous odds, to stand up and to be counted, so to speak. But after this remarkable miracle, after this deliverance, we find that Elijah went back with Ahab to Jezreel, to the palace. Ahab went in to speak to Jezebel, to relate to her the events of that day and those things which had taken place. Elijah was exalted. Elijah was on the mountaintop. He believed that the worship of the true God was going to be reinstituted. And so he had high hopes as to the outcome of this meeting between Ahab and Jezebel. And he had a particular expectation in his own mind as to what the outcome would be. That indeed, the reverence of Jehovah would be brought back before the minds of the people, and that he would have the cooperation of the rulership of Israel. But instead of this matter changing the mind of Jezebel, Jezebel's response to the slaying of the priest of Baal and the prophets of the grove was one of violence. And she threatened to kill Elijah. Now try to picture for yourself this scenario. Try to remember the marvelous miracle that God had wrought at the hands of Elijah just hours before this, practically. Elijah outnumbered 850-1. He is surrounded by the children of Israel who had gone into idolatry in the worship of Baal. And yet he was not intimidated. But here, on this occasion, Jezebel threatens his life. And what does he do? He flees into the wilderness. He becomes fearful and discouraged, and he flees into the wilderness. It's difficult for us to understand, in a way, but in other ways it's not. For even the great Apostle Paul became discouraged on occasion. And we'll believe that that is the lesson that the Lord is trying to convey to us here. Since Elijah does represent the church in the flesh, it is telling us that there were times in the church's career where discouragement was a particular danger. Elijah's discouragement was such that he even asked God to take his life. We're told in verse 4 of chapter 19, he went a day's journey into the wilderness and came and sat down under a juniper tree, and he requested for himself that he might die, and said, "It is enough now, O Lord, take away my life, for I am not better than my fathers." And as he lay and slept under the juniper tree. And so, Elijah, because he expected a particular result of the Lord's workings amongst his people, and that particular result did not come to pass, he became discouraged. What was the source of his discouragement? Why did he become disheartened? It's important for us to ask this question, because if Elijah represents us, then this is something that we have to consider in our own lives. Why did Elijah become discouraged? Because things didn't work out the way that he thought that they would. And so he began to doubt and to wonder in his own mind if things were working out at all, as to whether or not God's will really was being accomplished amongst his people. And the result of his discouragement, a number of things occurred that were not desirable. His fleeing into the wilderness, his inactivity, his resting under the juniper tree, and the word juniper means yoke or bondage. We feel it's appropriate in its application here. And he fell asleep. A
period in the church's history, evidently, where they became sleepy. But this is not the end of the story either. For as he slept under that juniper tree, behold, an angel touched him and said unto him, Arise and eat. Now, if we look for something after 1799 that would correspond to this angel awakening the Elijah class from a condition of lethargy and feeding them, providing once again some sustenance, we cannot help but consider the Miller movement of 1829 to 1844 as a possible fulfillment of this part of the picture. But Elijah fell asleep again. The disappointment of 1844, when those who expected that the Lord would return at that time, was very great. And once again, discouragement came upon them. The meat, the food that was supplied to them through that angel of the Miller movement was not sufficient to keep them awake and active. And so they fell asleep once again. But there was another angel that came a second time in verse 7 and touched him and said, Arise and eat, because the journey is too great for thee. And he arose and did eat and drink and went in the strength of that meat 40 days and 40 nights unto Horeb, the Mount of God. We believe the application here to this other angel who awakens and feeds Elijah the second time to bring us to 1874. And Elijah was strengthened for a journey and went in the strength of that meat for 40 days and 40 nights, bringing us to 1914, to Mount Horeb, the Mount of God. But the word in the Hebrew means the Mount of Destruction. And we believe that both are significant and applicable to the picture. 1914 did bring Elijah, did bring the church in the flesh to the Mount of God, to the Mount of Destruction, the time of trouble, the day of the Lord, the day of vengeance of our God. What was Elijah's reaction at this point? As we're tracing this, we are seeing these many times in which Elijah had become discouraged. 1914 came, and what does Elijah do? He went into a cave, and he lodged there, and he hid there. And it was at this point that the Lord asked this all-important question. Elijah, what are you doing here? Elijah was still discouraged. Things were not working out the way that he anticipated them. This is demonstrated in his response. And he said, I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, for the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword, and I, even I only, am left, and they seek my life to take it. Elijah was doubting in his mind. He was discouraged because he didn't feel that things were working out as he had expected, and thus began to doubt as to whether the Lord's will was really being accomplished amongst his people. And what did the Lord do for Elijah? He told him to go forth and to stand upon the mount, and he gave him a vision. And we're familiar with this vision, the vision of the time of trouble. The wind, the earthquake, the fire, and the still small voice. But afterwards, after Elijah had even seen the hand of God in this vision of the time of trouble, he was still discouraged. And God had to ask him the question a second time. Elijah, what are you doing? From the context, the Lord asked this question because there was something that Elijah was supposed to be doing that he was neglecting. And it was as a result of his discouragement that he was neglecting that which he was supposed to be actively engaged in. Now, dear friends, if we are the Elijah class, and I believe we are, then there are lessons contained here for us, important lessons. Let us consider what we have looked at thus far. Although Elijah was a mighty man of God, he was frequently prone to discouragement. And that discouragement was generally a feeling that God's will was not being accomplished amongst his people. The latter part of this scenario particularly emphasizes that discouragement. And as we've seen the chronological reckoning, it would take us down to the period of Laodicea. And therefore, the discouragement factor would be particularly strong for the Laodicean period of the church. The result of this discouragement was inactivity. The discouragement paralyzed Elijah to the point where he was unable to do that which was his mission. The circumstances today amongst the Lord's people, as they have been many times in the past, might have a tendency of having a similar effect upon us, of discouraging the Lord's people into feeling that the Lord's will is not being done. And as a consequence, we could become lethargic, sleepy, inactive. And so the Lord's question to us is the same as it was to Elijah. What are you doing? We would like to address this question, first of all, from the standpoint of the Lord's will. For this seems to be the crux of the problem in Elijah's mind. He expected a particular fulfillment of things, that things would work out in a particular way. That the Lord's will was going to be done in a particular fashion, as he expected it. Now, if we represent the Elijah class, and this question applies to us, then we have to ask ourselves whether the Lord's will is being accomplished today or whether it isn't. But this is the same question that was going through Elijah's mind. It was the same thing that he was struggling with. It is our solemn duty to determine what the Lord's will is concerning us. And this question, therefore, is important to us from that standpoint also. And even after determining the Lord's will, there becomes the even more difficult part to perform his will, to both will and to do of his good pleasure. How does the Lord's will affect us? What should we be doing? These are all important questions. Let us ask the question again. Is the Lord's will being accomplished today, or isn't it, amongst his people? To determine the answer to this question, we must first have a good understanding of the will of God in general. First of all, the Scriptures tell us very clearly that God's will is always accomplished. In Isaiah 14, verses 24 and 27, we read, "The Lord of hosts has sworn, saying, Surely as I have thought, so shall it come to pass, and as I have purposed, so shall it stand. For the Lord of hosts has purposed, and who shall disannul it? And his hand is stretched out, and who shall turn it back?" In Isaiah 46, verses 10 to 11, we read, "I am God, and there is none else. I am God, and there is none like me, declaring the end from the beginning, and from ancient times the things that are not yet done, saying, I have spoken it, my counsel shall stand, and I will do all my pleasure, I will also bring it to pass. I have purposed it, I will also do it." In Isaiah 55:11, "So shall my word be that goeth forth out of my mouth. It shall not return unto me void, but it shall accomplish that which I please, and it shall prosper in the thing whereto I sent it." These Scriptures clearly indicate that the will of God is always accomplished. However, a second point, the will of God operates in a very general way. God respects the free moral agency of his intelligent creatures. It is a fact that God's will is not always carried out by his intelligent creatures. But this does not interfere with the definite, fixed outlines of the divine program. "Surely the wrath of man shall praise thee, the remainder of wrath shalt thou restrain." Psalm 76, verse 10. Another point to consider, The accomplishment of God's will takes time. In many cases, thousands of years are required for the accomplishment of a single feature. The Lord's people have prayed for centuries, "Thy kingdom come, thy will be done on earth as it is in heaven." Matthew 6:10. Despite the seeming delay, no true Christian doubts that this prayer will be answered and that God's will in this respect will be accomplished. A fourth point, God is always in control. There are vast periods of time during which God's purposes gradually develop, leading towards the full accomplishment of His will. During these periods of development, God permits agencies to exist that are out of harmony with and even opposed to His will. There is abundant room in God's plan for all things that are in harmony with Him. All things out of harmony with Him must ultimately either be reconciled to Him or be destroyed. It is God's plan, will, or purpose to defer the destruction of all things not in harmony with Him until a future time, with the exception of the incorrigible amongst the church. And therefore, it leads us to another question, and that is the will of God as it affects His people, the Elijah class, the church in the flesh. The scriptures tell us that the church has been reconciled to God through Christ. Romans 5:10, 2 Corinthians 5:18 through 20, Colossians 1:20 through 21. By definition, then, we should expect that the Lord's people will be doing the Lord's will. If we are not doing the Lord's will, then either we are not the Lord's people, or we are in danger of ceasing to be such. Now, just to combat against the possibility of discouragement here, because Elijah was so prone to discouragement, let us consider. Certainly, we all fail to do the Lord's will from time to time due to our human weaknesses. These failures are covered by the robe of righteousness. We are given the promise that such failures will not work to our injury as long as our hearts are in the proper condition. We can depend on the Lord for His overruling of these failures. These are not the oppositions to the will of God to which we are referring. We are speaking concerning a willful opposition to the will of the Lord. Considering all these things, then, it seems inconceivable that God's will is not being accomplished by His people today. It is important, however, that we consider another factor. Just as in the case of Elijah, that he seemed to be a lone individual amongst the professed people of God, we cannot judge what God's will is merely by looking at what is being done by Bible students. Timothy was exhorted to be an example of the believer, with emphasis on the definite article in the Greek. The implication is that in his day there were many near believers, and thus it has been throughout the course of the church in the flesh. We must be careful here, however, to guard against an opposite extreme. We must remember the lessons of the Epistle of Jude and of other texts which tell us that we must have respect for the Lord's anointed, that we must have respect for the only arrangement which God has made for the church in the flesh, the only organization which He recognizes, the voice of the ecclesia. Where two or three of you are gathered in My name, there am I in the midst of you. We must have respect for that feature of God's organization. Those who are truly seeking and know to know and to do the Lord's will shall find it. This is a definite promise that is held forth to us in the Scriptures. The discerning of sound doctrine is not so much a matter of intellectual ability as it is heart condition.
My son, give me thine heart, for out of it are the issues of life. Our understanding of the truth is dependent upon our condition of heart. Yes, it seems unthinkable that God's will is not being accomplished today by His people. When God speaks, it is done. We, as the Elijah class, have the great privilege, as His people, of being used to carry out His will. If anyone fails to do the will of God consistently, persistently, willfully, then God will give His crown to another. The admonitions of the Scriptures are clear. Take heed that no man take thy crown. Let him that thinketh he standeth take heed, lest he fall. Revelation 3:11, 1 Corinthians 10:12. Does any one of us believe that our obstinacy could for a moment thwart the plans of the great God of the universe? Such a thing is unthinkable. Let us summarize the facts as we have them thus far in connection with this question. Is the Lord's will being accomplished today, or isn't it? God's will is always done in large matters that affect His plan. God's will is not always done by individuals. The Lord's people are those who are striving to know and to do His will. Individuals who follow a course that is in opposition to God's will cannot be or remain His children for very long. The actions of Bible students are not necessarily reflections of what God's will is for the church, for two reasons. Because of our weaknesses and human imperfection, but also because that there are many near believers as well as true believers. In view of these facts, it seems clear that the answer to this question becomes a matter of individual responsibility and individual stewardship. It is not for us to pass judgment upon anyone, not even ourselves, but we must examine ourselves whether we be in the faith. It seems evident that the Lord's true followers today are indeed performing His will. But the lesson from the life of Elijah is clear. Even though we as the Lord's people may discern the Lord's will, may have determined clearly what it is in our lives, and may be endeavoring to the best of our ability to pursue it, we must be careful that we do not judge the Lord's will by the results of our efforts. We must be careful that we do not judge the Lord's will by the result of our efforts, either individually or collectively. We must beware of the pitfall of discouragement that can come to us. Elijah was a mighty man of God. He knew what the Lord's will was, and he did it. But because the results were not what he expected, he became discouraged. What is our present responsibility then? What are you doing, Elijah? We must first seek the Lord's will. We can rest assured that if God has something that He wants us to do, and if we are seeking to know His will, the Scriptures promise that it will be revealed to us. Our first responsibility in this connection is to prepare our hearts. We must be on the lookout for the revealment of God's will by whatever means He sees fit to reveal it. Once we have determined it, then the harder task of performing it becomes our responsibility. To do the Lord's will. Be ye doers of the word and not hearers only, deceiving your own selves. James 1:22. For it is God which worketh in you, both to will and to do His good pleasure. Philippians 2:13. If after determining the Lord's will, and then endeavoring to the best of our ability to perform it. What if our experience is similar to that of Elijah's? What if it seems to us that his will isn't being accomplished? Then what is our responsibility? The natural tendency for us, as it was for him, was to point the finger at someone else. You remember his reply? I have been very jealous for the Lord God of hosts, but the children of Israel have forsaken thy covenant, thrown down thine altars, and slain thy prophets with the sword. And I'm the only one that's left, and they're trying to kill me. Have you ever felt that way? Has the Lord's people, collectively, have they ever felt that way? The time period through which we are passing is very similar to a previous time period in Earth's history. There was a picture of this time period on a much smaller scale that was painted for us by the Lord through historical event. And that historical event was the French Revolution. And you may recall some of the expressions that have been used to describe that time period. It was the worst of times and it was the best of times. And I think that the time period during which we are living is the fulfillment of that to the largest extent possible. Of all the time periods in Earth's history and in the plan of God for us to be living, today is the most significant. Today is the most important as far as the church's career in the flesh. But it's a mixed blessing. Along with all of the benefits and the privileges that we have also come the many pitfalls. It is indeed the best of times and the worst of times combined. And because of this, there may be a tendency on the part of the Lord's people to become discouraged by the events that are going on around us. But we're not just talking about the events in the world. We're not just talking about the time of trouble, financial collapse, political instability, religious upheaval. All of these things are significant to us, and we look at them, but we're also talking about the problems within. The problems amongst ourselves, amongst those who call themselves the Lord's people. That was the primary source of Elijah's discouragement. We must avoid the natural tendency to point the finger at someone else. We must, first of all, look at ourselves and question whether or not we have truly and correctly ascertained the will of God. We should further search to see whether or not we have the time element correct in whatever our particular expectations may be. The Lord's purposes are different at different times. We must be certain that we have correctly determined and read the will of the Lord. Now, if we still feel that the Lord's will is not being accomplished, then it is up to us, as that Elijah class, to consider that important question which the Lord asked him. Elijah, what are you doing? There is something for us to do. We have a mission to perform. We have a purpose for being here. And it is up to us to accomplish that purpose. We must redouble our efforts to do with our might what our hands find to do. And hopefully, such an example will prove a stimulus to others of the Lord's people to help to flag, to help to stir up their flagging courage. But ultimately, if things don't work out the way we expect them to, ultimately, we must leave the rest to the Lord. We must leave it in His hands and trust that He is working all these things out according to the counsel of His own will. As in the case of Elijah, we may not always be able to ascertain the results of the working out of His will. The Lord is quite capable of handling His own affairs. He can do quite well without any of us. It is His love and His mercy that finds a place for us in His plan. And so we should not feel that the Lord's plan is going to fail, or even that it could be delayed if we or any number of us should fail to do His will. His will shall be accomplished. His word shall not return unto Him void. In conclusion, let us summarize once again and consider these important lessons from the life of Elijah and their application to us at this end of the age. One of the special tests of our day is to be patient endurance. Let us try to remember the lessons that we can learn from the lives of the faithful ones who've gone before us, both of the Old and of the New Testament, these mighty men of God. Let's learn from their victories and from their strengths, but let's also learn from their weaknesses and from their mistakes. The question that came to Elijah is the same one that comes to us. What are you doing? We have something to do. The Lord wishes us to be active in His service. Whatever you feel that activity involves. We're not just simply talking about public witnessing. That's a part of it. But we're talking about activity in the Lord's service and the carrying out of our consecration. Whatever activity the Lord may be pleased to permit us to engage in. But if we look at what's going on today in the world and amongst ourselves, and if we become discouraged because we feel that our efforts are all in vain, then we have fallen prone to the same discouragement that Elijah did. Let us not make the same mistake that he made. The Lord has given us not only a vision of the time of trouble, but He's given us a vision of the glorious outcome. We must keep that vision before our minds. We must not allow the vicissitudes of this life to deter us from the one thing that we have to do. Let us continue to press on. Let us continue to fight the good fight of faith. Lay hold upon eternal life. Don't become discouraged. There's something for you to do. The Lord is asking you to do that. May He bless us all to this end.